and welcome to the Triathlon Coach Podcast. My name's Simon Ward and I'm your host for this weekly show where my goal is to share practical, usable advice from the best athletes, coaches and experts from the world of triathlon so that you can get the most from your training time and maximise your enjoyment of the triathlon lifestyle. If you don't already know me, I'm the founder of thetriathloncoach.com and the SWAT Inner Circle, and I've been a triathlon coach for over 20 years, working with absolute beginners right up to Olympic athletes and coaching them to race at distances from sprint through to Ironman. Reviews and ratings are the currency of podcasts, so if you enjoy today's conversation, I'd really appreciate it if you could drop into iTunes, Podbean or Stitcher and leave a rating and a review. And while you're there, please subscribe to our weekly episodes so that they can be downloaded straight into your phone or your iPad or wherever you choose to listen to them. And finally, to say thank you, I have a free gift for you. I've put together 25 of my top tips amassed from 30 years of racing and training and coaching in the sport. All you have to do is email triathlonsuccess to beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she'll send it right out to you. Okay, now it's time to crack on with today's guest. Hello, listeners. Welcome back to another podcast with another fantastic guest today, a man who I consider to be one of the most influential triathlon coaches, certainly in the UK, maybe in the world. In a second, I'll introduce you to him. His name's Chris Jones. But first, let me tell you some of the things he's done in a very impressive coaching career. He's currently the Welsh Athletics National Coach. Prior to that, Chris was also the Director of Coaching and Director of Performance for Triathlon Ireland. He was a performance coach for British Triathlon. He was instrumental in the setting up of Bath University as a high-performance triathlon centre. Probably, I think it was the first triathlon centre in the UK. And he was also the head coach for British Triathlon at the Sydney Olympics. So welcome to the show, Chris.
I mean, it's lovely to be here. Lovely to catch up, as always.
Yeah, it's taken us a while, hasn't it? On and off, toing and froing, trying to find an appropriate time.
It always does, but when we do, we always seem to have these conversations that do go on for a while, but it's always enlightening, so it's really great to be chatting time. It's great.
Yeah, well, you're the second podcast call I've got today, Chris, and you'll be coming, your call will come out after the one that I've just recorded, so it'll be the second week. But I was talking to a young man, he's not so young anymore, and he's also a doctor, but you'd have known him when he was a young man, Dan Plews.
Oh, yeah. Dan was, a hard-working athlete, you know, probably a bit limited in a natural talent base. But he was just one of those guys that give you everything. And what was interesting about Dan was he just had a real fascination for the sport, and you could tell that early on. And obviously he's gone on to bigger things with his sports science and coaching career himself. You know, lovely guy.
Well, I don't know if you know, and I told Dan I was going to be speaking with you, and so I said that we'd have a chat about him, and so hopefully he's not too embarrassed. But Dan has actually gone on to be a very impressive Ironman athlete. I'm not sure if you're aware that last year in Kona, he was the fastest age grouper, so he was the Ironman age group world champion, and he actually set a record in Kona, 8:24.36 he rode, so he was 10 minutes faster than the previous best. He made it to the top eventually, found his niche.
He found his niche. Brilliant, Dan. That's really good.
Yeah. So there you go, Dan. I told you that I'd talk to your old mentor and mention you. So there we go. Anyway, Chris, let's talk about your coaching. I've known you. Our first meeting was via a telephone call. I recall it now vividly. Probably 1995, I'd written an article for 220 magazine about strength training for triathletes, a topic that's still very close to my heart and one which I'm still battling to get triathletes to understand. But you rang me up completely out of the blue. We'd never talked, we'd never met before. And there was this call from Chris Jones, who was one of the leading triathlon coaches.
Yeah, I think there weren't many people at that time really putting things out there. And it was clear that you were one of those people that were prepared to put things out there. And it just always fascinated me in the, you know, the linkage between what we do in our sport. And, you know, even though we were very fixated on volumes and training and, shall we say, I just think the coaching community at that time were a long way behind on things. I think the better athletes at the top of the game knew more than we did. And we were sort of finding his way. That led to that phone call. That led to someone who knew about strength and conditioning, but also the specific side of what you were talking about, what was relevant for triathlon at that time. So that's why I rang him. Yeah.
So we've kept in touch and been friends ever since. But I'm interested in what's your backstory before coaching, Chris? I know that you were in the army, and I know that you were in the army cross country team, but I don't know much more than that.
It's quite varied, actually. And when you talk about performance, but I was a musician, actually. I was a musician, and I played not a bad level. I played with the Chamber Orchestra, and I did a few sort of bigger gigs with good orchestras. But I was a French horn player. I came from Halifax as a brass band person, with my father was a brass band player. And I went into the army then to be a bandmaster. So I always thought I was going to be a music teacher. I ran, and I would say I was probably just about a county standard runner. But then I drifted. In my unit, we had a guy called Malcolm Hurst, who was Olympic biathlon coach. So I ended up then doing 5 years on the biathlon team, probably just underneath that Olympic group, and got to a reasonable level. And again, learned so much through that process. And then again, while coming out of that, running in the army, I always had a fascination. And I ran this race, which was an Army Championship 5000. I think fifth that day. It was my first time I'd done it. And there was a chap at the end who came over to me and said, "Who are you?" And at the time, I said, "I'm Bansman Jones." He said, "Bansman Jones?" I said, "Yeah, Bansman Jones." And it was Ray Butters. It was Ray Butters, who was in the PT Corps at the time. We became great friends. And I said, "Well, can I ring you?" He said, "I'd be interested in helping you." And he did. And he started coaching me. And through all my career while I was in the services, really, Ray coached me. But we had a fascination outside that for many, many years. We just stayed in touch and still do stay in touch and still... It's really interesting to see him recycle himself from back, and obviously he's working with Jess, and I've seen him working with a lot of athletes. And I've had that conversation around, you know, where he is now and his philosophies. And he just had some very good principles with him. I would say he was probably my first mentor, no doubt about that.
Yeah, so for those of you who don't know, Chris just mentioned there, Ray Butters is a coach now. I think he's based in Ripon, but... works very closely with Jess Learmonth, and has done for a number of years, and so has been instrumental in her rise to the top of the world triathlon scene, really. He's got a small group of people. I think Tom Bishop probably swims with that group as well sometimes. So he's like you say, Chris, he's old coaches never die, do they? They just sort of like reinvent themselves.
No. And he always had a fascination. And it was interesting, you know, I've still got some of his old schedules. What was interesting about Ray was the detail that he sent you, because it was always distance coaching in the road. And I was always fascinated. I used to get this brown envelope with this immaculate schedule handwritten inside it. But it was the detail, and it's always impressive that he could be bothered to put that level of detail into like a 5-week framework of training. It was great.
Mm. Well, it's interesting that there is a thread running through this, because I mentioned that I've just talked with Dan, and Dan used the word about being fascinated and being interested and engaged with certain subjects, which, you know, have helped shape his performance as an athlete, but also as a coach working with Olympic rowers. You talk about fascination. Ray was fascinated clearly and engaged and had that enthusiasm. Malcolm Brown would be the same. Jack would be the same. And I think there's no coincidence that the people who rise to the top of the game, the same with athletes. You know, Dan mentioned about being an athlete. And again, Malcolm Brown's mentioned it about you need to have an enthusiasm and a love for the sport first in order to do it. I know the Brownlees have talked about that. And it seems like the best coaches also have that inquisitiveness and fascination for what they're doing. It's more than just a job for them.
No, absolutely. I think it's an intrinsic passion. It's the learning. It's the it's how certain coaches work. But it's holistic, putting the person first, and that's key to everything I think I've ever done. And also being really comfortable, I think, in a space of like, I don't own anybody. I've never owned anybody. And I think, you know, you accept that you're working in this frame that you've just been asked to work in with this part of this athlete's career. And I always smile when I get the conversation with coaches, I can see myself taking this one all the way to the Olympics or to a world level. And it's as if they're missing the point, actually. The point is the athlete standing in front of you and just do the best you can around that environment that they're asking you to work in. And how long that lasts, who knows? But it doesn't matter. The fact is that you should be comfortable in that space and create those environments. And that allows you then to work at the level of detail that you want to do. And again, some athletes very much want the detail and want to know. And as you know well, Simon, some athletes just say, tell me what to do. It's getting the right fit. I think that's one thing I became very comfortable early on, is that I recognised I was a person that I wasn't great with big numbers. I recognised that early on, particularly around the early part of British triathlon career. But I was better when I was just working with smaller numbers. And since then on, I've probably stayed away from trying to work bigger groups, you know.
You had a reasonable group when I first met you, though, didn't you? I think you were running a group called One Vision Coaching before you became a performance coach for British Triathlon. So how did that all come about?
It was interesting. You know, the guys suddenly started gravitating. A few results off Matt Belfield at the Worlds as a junior. Took him to Manchester, 16th or 18th that time of the world. And all of a sudden, you just became a little bit of a flavour of a month of a coach that gravitated in the area of people with the coach. And so, you know, I started giving up work and started charging, not much money, and people come along and ask for help. And I recognise that, the guys who want to go somewhere at the top, it wasn't a question of setting their business like that. It was actually creating just something that would allow me more time to coach. And so I used to run a bike training camp out of Horsham, Christ College, with Tom Hills down there and those boys, and they set it all up and it says, come down here and we'll support you. So they did. So they nearly gave me free facilities. I went down there. I used to have about 60 athletes turn up a weekend. I bring in lots of other coaches to help me. But my eye really was only on probably the top 6 to 8 athletes in that group that was trying to push up the GB standard, shall we say. But I also got a lot of satisfaction out of seeing age group athletes winning world titles and medals and British championships, and it was a really nice time to develop. But if you ask me whether the detail was, you know, where it should have been at that time, I'd probably admit that it wasn't. And I was very much learning about the sport at that time, and just happened to be working with a few guys who were good athletes, who were really good athletes at that time. Whether they could have gone to the next level, or you know, perhaps were a little bit behind our understanding of how to get them to the next level, really at that point. Because it was very, very early on. The World Cup was arriving, really. The run-up towards Sydney. It was very raw at that time. But yeah, that's how I created One Vision, really, as a vehicle, just to, because the athletes asked, could we have more time? And so I said, okay, I'm prepared to stop working. And that's what I did. Yeah, that's how I did it, with a bit of swim teaching and coaching around the area to eventually get a position where I could, like yourself, become one of these coaches that, committed more time to it.
Let's rewind a bit from there then, because there's a gap between when you were working with Ray and how you got into coaching. So did you work with Ray as a coach then, or did you start coaching athletes of your own in running or biathlon?
No, I did quite. I just naturally gravitated to coaching the group of guys when I was in the services for that period. And then when I came out, I did in partnership with a few people I was involved with. And in that area, in Stoke, there was Chris Muir, there was Matthew Belfield, and Belfield was a talent, he was a good athlete, and, you know, his coach had come across and discussed about his running program at the time, and that's how it started. That was my first introduction to what is this sport of triathlon. And that's how I started just sort of working in those areas. I swam to quite a high level as a kid, so, I wasn't a bad swimmer, I understood swimming. Cycling wise, you know, it was something that you, in those days, prior to the drafting, the majority of athletes I was working on was, cadence, power, time trialing, gear ratios. And it wasn't that hard to understand, really, if you understood a little bit about physiology. But being honest in anything I've ever done, just like ringing you up regarding something I'm missing, I'd be down the road. I remember discussing with, Peter Reid in North Yorkshire, or Yorkshire, was the guy who produced the time trialing.
Peter Reid.
I had a great conversation with him. I'd say, And I sent him a card once, just appreciating the time he'd taken. He says, this guy who produced all these guys that could, you know, Dangerfield and all these guys that could write incredible time trials. And so I went down that route. I thought, well, I need to speak to him. And he helped me. He helped me in the early days to understand a lot more about that area, which obviously eventually came into drafting. Yeah.
Yes, I remember that turbo training book by Peter Reed. I think I might still have a copy somewhere. That there was probably 30 turbo training sessions of various different formats, and I'd lock myself in the garage with one.
I think 90% of them was sheer agony.
Okay, so you were coaching One Vision. You then went to Bath, didn't you? When did you go to Bath University? Because they set up the high performance unit there. Was that late 90s?
Yeah, late 90s. So it was quite interesting. So I was around the fringes of British triathlon, but not even as a British triathlon coach or anything. Steve True was the lead coach of British triathlon at the time. He'd invited me to a few sort of training camps, and I remember bumping into Bill Black at the time. The pair of us had been invited as coaches to get more involved with British triathlon. I think it's probably just because the large amount of athletes I had that were involved with the age group teams. So I think that was the first introduction to that. And then off the back of that, they appointed an advertiser for first performance director. The performance director is Grégoire Millet from France. Highly skilled guy, educated, and right at the cutting edge of triathlon at that time, probably in Europe and France. And Grégoire came to see me. Grégoire came to see me, had a talk around a few things, and asked me if I would be involved in a more formal capacity. I took a trip down to Bath. I had a meeting with, it was Richard Hobson, actually. And to be honest, Richard Hobson should take a lot of credit here, because he was a guy who was the guy behind setting up Bath. There's no doubt about that. He had a vision that triathlon should go to Bath. He had a link with Jed Roddy, who was also the director of sport in Bath University. Very, very ambitious. And so I had a meeting with the guys, and Richard, who was, you know, to be fair to Richard, at that point there, he could have taken over that role himself, probably as head coach, but he didn't. He didn't, actually. He came and talked to me and chatted about would I be interested in going down there and working with him. And that was it. So I did. And they advertised and I interviewed, and Grégoire was the director of performance. And that was my initial start. And I did a year, really, as a little bit of a consultant working on the circuit with the women's team prior to that role. And then started formally in 99 with a brief of raising the standards prior to Sydney Olympics. That's what that was. Yeah.
And at Bath at that time, then you had some. Did you have most of the Olympic team training down there? You certainly had quite a lot.
Yeah, we did. Obviously, Simon came into us from France. Five times world champion. I mean, he'd be six times world champion at that time, actually. And he came
For those listeners who aren't familiar with British triathlon 20 years ago, this is Simon Lessing we're talking about here.
Yeah, who at that time, I think, Simon, you would agree, he was the best standalone athlete in the world. And he was a very much an individual man who, I wouldn't say self-coached, because he had a good run coach, but he knew exactly what Simon needed, shall we say. And so we were at a point there where I would say he was light years ahead of where we were and our thinking at that current time. And it was great to have him in the program, because we had to move at pace to integrate a lot of things around him. And, you know, the level of athletes we had there were good athletes, but they were not athletes at his level. There were athletes that were developing and developing well on the male side, on the, Richard Allen, Craig Ball, were probably the Stuart Hayes came into that role then, really as a youngster, as a junior. But we were stronger in the women. We had obviously Michelle Dillon, world bronze medalist at that time. Leander Kerr, obviously became a world champion, and the double junior world champion, Annalise Hurd. So, and then off the back of that, we had a university program, and the Dan Blue, you know, not Dan Blue's, the guy who did the swimming book in Paul Newsom.
Paul, oh yeah, Paul. Yeah.
Paul. So Paul and the guys were down there as well, as a university program. So, and that then became, you know, what, where we were working. And eventually, Drew Dibbs came down. Drew Dibbs from America joined us. And, you know, we had a mixed array of ability at the top end and a big squad. And eventually we split the roles between myself and Richard. And, but that was the format. And obviously the first pressure point there was building towards the first ever Olympic Games in Sydney. You know, and if you look at the majority of athletes, they were in that pool. They were in that pool. You know.
Was Jodie there then? Jodie Swallow, or was she a bit young then?
Jodie came slightly after. She came more when I moved over to Swansea, and she came in, and then I got picked up by Richard at that time. So that was pre-Athens, right. That moved on to the pre-Athens series. Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk about the Olympics. The first ever triathlon in the Olympics, Sydney 2000. Simon Lessing, that you've mentioned, he was the overwhelming favourite for that. But I think most people in Britain, certainly in British triathlon, thought that he would just have to turn up to win. But let's just go back a little bit before then, because in order to make it into the Olympics, triathlon, as we knew it when we first met, which was, as you talked about, was basically a time trial on the bike, a swim. Yeah. And a run. So and then what changed was they introduced draft legal racing. So there's a couple of things there that I'm interested in. As a coach, you must have had to scramble very quickly to learn about this different type of riding, not just in terms of the skills required for the riders, but also the impact that the swim was going to have on that, and the impact that the riding was going to have on the running, and tactically, and how that's going to change the dynamic of the event. So, what did you do at that point there to get up to speed?
It was interesting. Swim speed wise, I look back at those days, and the level of swim speed in the women was phenomenal. And if you look back at how well the Australians were doing at that time, they had the Formula One series, which was the drafting races, high octane intensity, and the skill level of what they're doing was way ahead of where we were. There's no doubt about that. It was way ahead of us. And so, like you say, there was a scramble catch-up period, and we had to go about it. We had to use circuits like Castlecombe. We had to bring in a lot of cycling sort of coaches. We brought in a lot of hard and seasoned road racers that were riding in the groups, and all the camps and all the preparation phases, we'd have people in there that'd be really coaching. I mean, I remember bringing Sarah Symington out to a camp, and Sarah, who works, I think she works with Archie now, but Sarah was, you know, just one of those hardened road racers, getting stuck into the girls, riding around a loop, you know, we'd be doing crit loops, technical loops, and we'd really, really, and we were really accelerating them quickly. So that eventually they could cope with this style of racing. And the girls in that 2 year period prior to Sydney Olympics, they were ranked 13th in the world as a team. And we got them in that year after that to third in the world and secured 3 slots for the Olympic Games. And to be honest, that came mainly from that component of what you're talking about. They could all run. The majority of the British girls like Sean Bryce and, those Annie Emerson, they could all run. And what was lacking was just this level of skill on crit-type racing. You're absolutely right. We did scramble, but we didn't do it on our own, Sam. We brought a lot of help in around us. And Richard Hobson was fundamental to getting his hands on those people because he was very embedded in the cycling world around at the time. And that's what we did. And eventually we had people like Mark McKay employed in British Triathlon. And his job was just to do that, upskill people. And he had a huge value then going into the Olympics. It was great.
The second thing I'm interested in is, as a coach, you would have been dealing with those athletes, some of whom would have taken to draft legal racing. They would have had the skills and they would have had the physiology to cope with surges in power and then backing off, whereas others, I guess, would have had a physiology that was more suited to constant application of power. But given that you didn't really, probably didn't have as much knowledge about that at that time, What was required of you as a coach in terms of managing those athletes who would probably be, some of them would have probably been complaining about this, that, you know, I'm not suited to this and I don't like it. And of course, they're still elite athletes and you've got to try and effect that change, and others who would take to it. So how did that affect your coaching and what new skills did you have to develop there?
I think you're right, first of all. I think like managing any elite environment at times, particularly what you've just said there, actually brings it back to how quickly it was moving and the landscape was changing so, so quickly. And, you know, you had guys that could probably ride a 52, should I say, 40k time trial. They're all very good at those sort of things. In the stochastic nature of it, they were just getting exposed. They were getting exposed on skill level. And also the fact that they didn't have the physiology. And we had to change a lot of things. We had to change a lot of the approach of how we transition people. We had to change a lot of work from British cycling, how we tested people. We also had to change our approach of actually finding out the linkage of what people could do. And I remember doing a piece of work where we did a 200-meter time trial, 400 at race pace, and then 100 flat out or something. And then they ran up the stairs and they came all the way up onto an SRM. And then they had to do so many stochastic type jumps, just like you have to do when you're really coming out. And we were really profiling athletes at that stage who could and who couldn't do it. You know, so that's the type of work that was going on in the background. The management of that, I think you get, the level you're working at, you get to a bit of a reality check quite early on that, you know, your investment or the athletes you're working with, it gets to a point where you do know they have the profile, they also have the tenacity, shall we say, to adapt to those environments. And they don't, and the ones that don't, unfortunately, they get exposed. You know, they'll be dropping off packs, they can't follow up the intensity, or they can't get on the first pack because they don't have the stochastic nature of the power after a hard run. And they'll come back. And I was nearly, you know, I remember stories of, like, I was nearly there, and if I had made the pack, I had finished fourth. My number's so good, but the reality of the day, you did make the pack. And after a while, you honestly come into it as a coach to say, I don't have a race for you, it's moved on. And I think, there's good examples of athletes in that space that I'm sure we can talk about. You know.
I mean, when we look at things now in terms of the critical split points in the WTS races, it's making that first pack, isn't it? 100%. You know, and there's definite understanding from the athletes about who's going to be in the first pack, who's not going to be, what tactics might be employed. If, you know, if a Brownlee's in the first pack and a Mola's in the second pack, then we just hammer the bike for the first couple of laps to make sure he doesn't get up. And then, you know, that's happened. But did you have to scramble as well to help the athletes gain an appreciation of the importance of tactics as the style of racing changed?
I think you did. And I think there's a lot of things going on then, Simon. You know, the bike riding, you know, particularly at that time, it became quite personality dependent, just like you'd said. So if you'd had like Craig Walton, you had Simon away, I can't remember the French guy now, you just knew the amount of power that was going to go down that road on that first few kilometres, shall we say. If you were not on those guys' wheels, you just weren't there. And if you look at those type of athletes now, the size of those athletes, they're incredibly powerful athletes with a very, very good split profile. So there was that going on. But at the same time, with those athletes, they were starting to question how fast the running was starting to unfold. So you then had Whitfield, who I thought biomechanically just about changed the sport. I thought Simon Whitfield, the Olympic champion in Sydney. When I saw that race, I saw Simon progress slow at that point. We had a new generation coming forward, and that was an absolute game changer of this sport. And Vukovic behind him, again, at that time, what they did, and there was disbelief. Robertson was a wild card from Australia. We always knew he could do something. And then we had our young Tim Don. Tim Don was emerging. He was Quinn's incredibly talented young athlete that can mix run speeds with most guys in the world, as a young guy and a young pretender. Yet we had the old guard coming into the first Olympic Games with this incredible profile, Smith Mine. And all of a sudden, he'd gone from fields of like 60, 70 athletes, we say, in a World Series event, to all of a sudden you're exposed to a real Olympic Games, where once you start taking certain personalities and names out of that, you get exposed. So the group that got away actually in Sydney on that race, particularly Lessing, he was exposed because he had Walton and he needed more people with him. And the rest of the people that were prepared for a hard ride, and stochastically, it was like a modern generation that could cope with that. Once they got there, obviously the race was then became and the running speeds had moved on. So that's kind of a long-winded answer to things, really. But I think there's a lot of things going on there, not just coping at that time. I think we had to go through a huge change in lots of areas really, really quickly, really quickly.
I think what you talked about there with the cycling, Chris, and bringing in other coaches to help you or help the athletes develop skills is something that we try to teach in British Triathlon, is that the thing that sets the elite coaches out isn't the fact that they're experts in these things. Oftentimes, they're not experts in swimming, biking or running, but they have enough of a knowledge to know when they need an expert, and they also know where to find those people who are highly skilled in that specific discipline. So it's almost like having a Rolodex of contacts, and the willingness to use them and the humbleness to use them and learn from them, that marks out elite coaches as much as it is about their own knowledge and coaching skills.
That's
something that's always stood out with you and with people like Malcolm Brown and Jack, is that willingness to say, you know, this is a team thing. We need a team approach, and I can't do this on my own, but what I can do is manage a group of people to help the athletes get better. And understanding also, when you're the lead coach, it's actually not about you, it's about the athletes. You're just in the background moving the pieces around to get the best results.
Absolutely. And I think also, just like, you know, me and you have been to many, many conferences, or we've been around many, many competitions, and there's times then when you just have that gem conversation, and you meet someone that just says a few things, you think there's a real relevance in that. And, you know, I had great friends with Bill Gavin in Australia. You know, at the time, we talk a lot about things. You know, he's the director of Australia, or head coach. And we share a lot of what was going on in the sport at that time. It wasn't that secretive, shall we say. And you know, you learn so much. I remember sitting in an auditorium with a guy called Bob Trofeen. Bob Trofeen was one of the leading swim scientists in the world. And Bob and I sat waiting for the Melbourne Commonwealth Games in this auditorium for about 3 hours, just discussing how you would and how you prepare. And he really got into the physiology of how he was working with David Davis at the time, the Olympic swim medalist. And there's so many things that you can learn from other sports and other people. And you need to look at broader. You need to look around you all the time. You need to bring in those expertise. My way of learning also, as you know, Simon, is through, is actually going and discussing things with people, and it sticks with me. And, you know, it's the way I learn best. And I would pick a subject, a topic, and I'd absolutely have a fascination around those things. And I'd have a network of people around the world, without a doubt, that I could pick up a phone and just a few things around higher level things like blood profiling, or like, you know, when you're looking at an athlete, sort of, I talk about hiking point when an athlete's ready to go. And it's understanding what those markers are. As life goes on with experience, you understand what those markers are more relevant to the athlete that's stood in front of you. So, you know, we're only as good, I think, we're only as good as where me and you are having a conversation in a coffee or at a bar, or, you know, learning from each other as we just keep going. Because as we sit here now, I'm 60, and we've known each other for 25 years. And those conversations have always been conversations that have been valued. And you've gleaned elements of knowledge from around the world like I have. But it's how you use that. It's how you then use that as an influencer with the athletes that you're working with.
Am I understanding right then that most of your knowledge that you have, which is vast and impressive, is not formal learning by going to study for a sports science degree, but from those conversations and contacts that you've had over the years, and just because you're fascinated in it, it tends to stick in your memory?
Yeah, I think so. Look, there's been some brilliant people that I've had the pleasure of working with, and Greg White, Dr. Greg White, who's the Mr. Celebrity, Doctor on TV, and those guys.
Yeah.
There's Greg. Fantastic personality.
but a guy that could really communicate and bring it to a level where you really understood it. And he was the first guy that opened up my thinking to thinking, I'm playing at this. I really don't know what I'm doing here. And so I went away, and obviously I read quite a few things that he gave me. That was one area, you know, and then, as I say, Jen's conversations with Bob Trapine. But again, two directors of performance that were very bright guys. And Gregoire Milly, again, learned a huge amount from Gregoire, because they were just fully established in France on their formal learning and how they developed coaching structures, developed coaching systems, and had a real understanding of actually where the sport of triathlon was before we established where, you know, our own thinking. And again, individually, then you meet people throughout your whole career, whether it's Nick Vidor from running or Alan Story. There's some great people. Malcolm Brown is a guy I hold in huge regard. And I've had a few conversations with Malcolm. I mean, I know we consider each other as friends when we see each other. I just never have had the opportunity to work with Malcolm, which is a regret, really, that he came in after I'd sort of finished with British Triathlon. This is the sort of guy that I would like to have worked with. You know, I think there's a philosophy and a common sort of common ground between us where we agree our athletes should be conditioned. So yeah, there are people there that influence, and it's what you do then, I would say, with that knowledge.
You touched on the Olympic triathlon there. What was the whole Sydney Olympics experience like for you, and what was the organisation of the triathlon like? You know, what were the things that happened behind the scenes that we might not have seen on the TV? One of your athletes was injured, wasn't it? Was it Julie Dibbins that had a foot injury or something?
Knee injury,
I think it was.
Knee injury. There are things that make, you know, mark any Olympic game or any campaign. And I think the one thing you learn, and the one thing I'd say to anybody, is that you've got to manage your energy and your energy reserves. And on that first Olympics going in there, two years on the road, raising the bar, spending time with athletes in camps and just following the World Cup series, basically. And then obviously there's preparation going into Olympic Games for the first time. Could it have been better? It definitely could have been better. There's no doubt about that. British Olympic Association were obviously well organized, and the preparation camp and holding camp, all those things were really, really good. But you know, the price to qualify that at that time was high. And you know, Julie Dibbins, particularly, picked up a knee problem. And I always remember that was the first situation of, like, you know, a proof of fitness situation. Where, and how do you handle it? This athlete spent the vast amount of a 2-year period and qualified outright for Olympic Games. And then you're there looking at something, one, as a personal coach, and two, as a head coach, knowing that this was not going to happen. Rod Jeggs, who is incremental to a lot of support around medical side of things and one of the leading medical doctors in the UK without a doubt, just has the right manner of how to support a coach and deal with that. And we'd obviously discussed that process of how Julie was going to go prove fitness, and we probably knew she couldn't. So we give her a timeline, and then you also then had to move the reserve, Michelle Dillon, into the space to obviously take over in that space and continue and keep the dynamic going in that group of people, which was difficult. It was very difficult. There's no doubt about that. I think there are a lot of lessons learned through the Olympic Games. You had an entity, Simon, who very much worked on his own. He wasn't really part of the structure of the team. He was part of the team. That would be harsh to say not. It was very much about keeping it as individual for him, what he needed with his French coach and things. And then where people who were outside that worked with different type of individual coaches. So as a learning curve at the first Olympic Games, it was difficult. It was difficult to just keep the balance between these. I was in charge of the women, and Bill Black was in charge of the men. And then over that, then Gregoire Milly obviously was the performance director. And I think, to be honest, we had a little bit of an arrogance there that Simon definitely, as you said, was just going to deliver this medal. But there were cracks appearing. There had been cracks appearing in a few races prior to that, and the world had moved on. And to be honest, I think we came out of that bruised. It was a brutal experience, I don't mind saying that, as a coaching group.
Dave Bellingham was team manager at the time, and I remember coming back with him saying, you know, that's one hell of an awakening to this, where this sport has actually now gone to. And, you know, the ability, talking to Peter Keane, who was in charge of British Cycling at the time, and Peter Keane, I remember walking with him afterwards, and he just said, your ability to control this sport without certain elements in your sport is going to be very difficult. And I think what it's just saying to you now is that this sport will change. And he was absolutely right in every word he said there. The domestic, the management, what it takes to manage that environment. The days of just certain individuals in that generation, they're gone. So we then went through a period then where we started to see significant change from other nations as well. So no, it was very, very difficult.
Everybody, athletes, coaches, has a bit of a come down after big events, particularly something that you talk about there, building up to that for 2 years, and it's a massive high. Sydney was a fantastic Olympics for everybody, wasn't it? You know, just a spectacle, the way the Australians put it on. So you'd have been on a high coming home, but of course, after every high, there's a low. Jörg Gotz, who's one of the coaches, works at Kayakers, and has talked about his own sort of mental health issues. And, you know, how did you cope in the aftermath of Sydney? You know, there must have been a period of self-reflection there. Did you feel that, like, there was any sense of loss and a bit of an empty space in your life?
There was. I just thought we weren't good enough. I remember saying to myself, I'm taking a lot of that personally, we weren't good enough. We didn't control enough. It was just too much at risk at times.
Okay, Chris, so back to it. So you were just saying about the come down after Sydney and the things that you realised about the sport, how you couldn't control it and how it was moving on and you had to change.
Yeah, I think it's a big reality check of, like, personally, like, there was a lot of, like, reflection on your own personal performance as a coach. Were you good enough? Did you really do everything you could have done in that environment? Could you have been better at things? And you reflect on those things, and I hope most coaches would reflect on those things. And then, you know, you also then, there is an appreciation. You've never done this before. It's never been done before. It's the first time it was in the Olympic Games. And were we naive? Were we a little bit naive about just the scale of what we were trying to do at that time? And I think honestly, I think there was a little bit naive in actually what we were trying to do and what we're trying to control. And there had to be a lot of self-reflection, and there was a brutal review coming through UK sport, and there was going to be some questions asked, and, you know, and then obviously we moved on from that, and you learn from that experience, but it's a harsh experience, and when you come back, it's a lonely experience, because it's, you know, as you know, the Olympic Games moves at pace, and people celebrate medals and celebrate success. And if you're not part of the party in that big theatre, shall we say, everybody's got every intention all the way up to those performances, those races. We were first on. We were about to set the Olympic Games off. They were diving off in front of Sydney Opera House. This was a big show. And unfortunately, it was the Simon Lessig show to get the medal, which I always feel really bad for. You have to carry that level of pressure. But that was the reality of where we were. And, okay, we didn't deliver on that. Within 24 hours in that program at the Olympic Games, Triathlon didn't exist. It exists at the next review meeting. 3 months down the line with UK Sport, what happened? And I think, yes, when you're walking around Sydney, you carry that around with you thinking, we've not delivered here. We've not achieved what we set out to deliver. And it was hard. It was really hard. I heard about that. It was hard. And you question your time and the sacrifice and not being at home and what that price is in your personal life. Those sort of things come into it, because they're in a lot of coaches' journeys, there's a story of huge sacrifice. It's a balancing act that not in any way an easy act to balance or normal. It's not a normal thing to be on the road for 15 weeks living around a group of athletes and not being at home. So the price is high, that's all.
So you got back into things. You did you had your review. You were still at British Triathlon, but then you moved over to Swansea in 2002, didn't you? What was behind that change there then?
Just for personal reasons. Both sports cars were very interested in me coming over this side. I was working with Helen Jenkins at the time, Helen Tucker in those days, Annalise Hurd, double junior world champion, Mark Jenkins, future Olympian in Athens, and obviously Leander Cave. And Leander Cave then had just secured the first world senior title. So they built this new centre. I came over to look at it, had a drive around, and the whole environment just tended to lent itself much more to triathlon. You know, it was coastal, it was rugged hills for the bike riding, quiet roads, and a facility that was absolutely brilliant. And also, it wasn't overused, so we could do what we want. So I thought it had a better environment actually for triathlon, the sport of triathlon. Bath, to be honest. Bath's a busy place, a busy city, and I just didn't think it compared. So it was a great opportunity to then move over to Swansea.
So you were involved with Mark and Helen, as you said, and I think you were coaching Andrew Johns as well, were you?
Yeah.
So did you go to Athens as a coach, or were you just involved with athletes who went?
I was involved with athletes who went. I was called in actually to go, and at that time there was a little bit of issues over. You remember the reserve situation? Obviously, Andrew Whitcomb was on the fringes there. There's question marks over fitness of Geordie Swallow and Julie Gibbons.
Yes.
They had to prove fitness. There was Achilles issues. Eventually, Julie Gibbons then did a domestic type job unofficially for Mr. Lillen. Yeah. So, yeah.
I remember that all got a bit out of hand, didn't it?
It did. And I think it was a Hodgkinson report after it identified a lot of those things again. But we were starting to move into identifying people that could work as a group, and we were trying to get more control of things. Johnsy at the time was in the front pack, and you know, the course in Athens was brutal. As he came off the bike there, I thought, got a chance, he's definitely got a chance here, but unfortunately the bike had taken the legs off him and he didn't run to how he should run. And Tim likewise, you know, Mark Jenkins had the famous crash where with a German guy, and was running down the hard shoulder with a bike on his shoulder trying to get a spare wheel, because Petzl, the German, had taken his back wheel off. So again, uncontrollables, but huge character when you look at, always remember that, Mark doing that, and just showed the character of who he is, that, you know. And I remember asking him, you know, you could have dropped out. And he said, no, I wouldn't have been an Olympian then, Chris. And I wanted to be an Olympian. Amazing story.
Actually, I think I'll have to try and find a photograph of that, because that is an iconic moment for British triathlon. Yes. I think it's sort of got lost in history now, but
It was, and you know, yeah, he, you know, his character just came through, and how he handled himself after that incident was incredible. Actually, first of all, he was just a hard-working athlete that wanted to be there for all the right reasons. Sometimes we lose those values when investment and performance goals are always heaped on us from, you know, the higher end, shall we say, of UK sport. Whereas he was there for all the right reasons. He'll be remembered for that. Yeah, definitely.
You stayed in Wales for about 5 years, didn't you? And then you went off to, did you go straight off to Ireland then, or did you have a bit of, did you have a bit of a lull in your coaching?
Yeah, it's interesting, and I say this quite openly. I think you've got a shelf life as a coach, and particularly when you work at a level of intensity across these programs. And you know, I think my two cycles, the energy levels were there. I thought British Triathlon were definitely going in a few different directions at that time. I don't think they were really clear exactly what their philosophy was with the high performance program at that time. And they were going through change. And they were going through change because of the pressure of not really ever delivering on the Olympic stage. Yet you and I know, Simon, we're winning everything else. Long course, you know, European medals, world medals, putting people on world podiums. That was something that we've become very good at. But the Achilles heel is we didn't have an athlete at that time who could control the environment within that Olympic type environment. And obviously that came later. But in that period then we didn't. So we're going through a lot of change. And I had to reflect. I really had to reflect on myself and think, well, I really enjoyed my time, really enjoyed it. And I had to work with some incredible people. But I really felt I had nothing else to really offer. And perhaps, and it was time for me to move on. I was tired. I needed a break. I took 3 months off when I finished. And then I started working with Sport Wales, of course, coaching development model. And I was working with about five sports as a lead that was doing a coach mentoring program. I think that was like, it was interesting, you know, judo, tennis, table tennis, squash, bit of athletics. And it was really, really enjoyable. And I realized how tired I was. And I really got my enthusiasm and appetite back to say, right, you know, this is great. And then phone call came out of the blue when I go do a lecture over in, presentation in Northern, in Ireland. So I did, and then I ran a clinic. And then it moved on from there. Would you do a few days a week? And I did. And at the same time, the Belgian Federation said the same. So I spent then a few days every month over in Leuven with the Belgian Triathlon Federation, looking at what they were doing and supporting their coaches. So huge opportunities arrived then from having been in such a well-established program that I'd done so well, but just unfortunately not got the, as I say, standalone athlete that could do with producing that Olympic medal. You know, I just don't think we had an athlete that could do that at that time. You know.
That relationship with Ireland then developed into something a bit more. So you became director of performance?
Yeah, I took on a head rope coach and then obviously the investment came with a little bit of success and the investment grew in Ireland and then there was a position of like, performance director. And if you look at small organizations sometimes and we put these adverts out and say you're a performance director of British Triathlon or, and I come back and say, well, are you a performance director? Are you a program manager? Or are you a head coach? Or are you a technical director? And so it's getting the right fit. So when I was offered that role, I just said, I would rather you put some good administration around this and I will act as a technical director so I can continue to invest in coaching and upskill coaching in Ireland. And that was the role, really. That was the focus, really. So I did put a proper coaching development program in Ireland.
Different aspect, though, of coaching for you. Not so much hands-on with the athletes anymore. Did that, was that a challenging change of mindset for you?
Yeah, it was. There's no doubt about that. But I think, you know, I think I was always comfortable that I knew I was there for a period of time. And, you know, I was trying to grow the investment. I had really good, had a good relationship with sports staff from Ireland and the key players, shall we say, at the Institute of Sport. And they didn't know very much about triathlon. So my role was to educate both sides of, from the sport itself and also at the higher level of investment. And so I really enjoyed that space and built some great relationships with people. And obviously, put a structure in place, a regional structure, a development program. And he eventually worked with a few individual athletes. The key was to raise the profile of the sport and obviously get athletes to the 2012 Olympic Games in London, which we did.
Mm. Now, I know that you're working with Welsh Athletics now, but before that, you sort of, while you were director of coaching for Triathlon Ireland, I think you had some involvement with some pure runners in Ireland as well. And then you sort of transitioned over to being a running coach, didn't you? And working for Athletics Ireland. Is that because running is really the passion for your life? Or was that just another job change?
No, I think from day one, there's always been a passion for running, which I drifted probably from the club fancy level into triathlon coaching. I've done this job in triathlon and the sport, athletic fans, is a bit of a different way. And the sports council asked me then to do a consultancy piece of work to go in and so I gave up a lot of work then in the UK that I was doing at Institute of Sport in Wales and went then into Athletic Ireland at the time there to help them put a structure in place. But then they could go out and be the youth performance director. There's just been sort of huge issues around staffing structures and court cases, and we just needed someone to come in and just clear the landscape and work with the committee to say, this is what we need to do. So I spent 6 months in there as a consultant doing that. And then I remember it was 2010, Barcelona, the European champion, Nuala Britton was out there with the case. She came and chatted and said, you know, what do you think? And we talked about a few things. And I said, she's doing the chase, and she's a very looking over the barrier. She's so short. I just said to her, like, I think you should consider looking at 5 and 10. And she was a brilliant natural prospector. And then that winter, she asked me to coach her. And I started coaching her in 2011. And she was fourth at the European Cross.
Yeah, she won the European Cross Country then in 2012. And that was a significant improvement, and running 31:28 for 10K. And then off the back of that, you know, she became the personality of endurance running, shall we say, in Wales, in Ireland. And then Irish Athletics asked me then if I would consider in 2012 going full time with them. So I did. That's where I went full time. And then I worked with a few other individual athletes over there. And that was a start. And it was a brilliant part of my life because it was working with single sport. And when you're working with single sport, the level of detail and the level of control just increases. Mm-hmm. It really increases. And it was a level of learning for me where it took me to a different place. And you've heard me a lot of time talk, Simon, in the past about understanding athletes in front of you, athletes profiling, understanding what you should do with athletes. And I suppose that was the opportunity that I'd probably been waiting for, to work with an athlete who had that sort of ability. And the year after that, we went back to the European Championships, which has never been done. It's never been repeated since. Anybody winning it back to back, but she won it again back to back in Budapest. And so, yeah, two great performances, fourth, first, fourth, and a career that she was the first non-African at the World Cross. So It was a really great opportunity, and you know, I was appreciative of the time I had working with her. You know, she was a phenomenal young athlete. You know,
yeah, and obviously that work in athletics has continued now then to the point where you're Welsh athletics national coach. So, is that working with endurance athletes there, or and just the distance runners, or are you involved with all of the athletes
across the world? Yeah, I came back from Ireland in a part-time role, just doing a couple of days a week there. And then I was also doing a UK England mentoring job. So I was mentoring sort of the higher end of coaches that are involved with endurance, which I really enjoyed that work as well. You met some great coaches. And yes, you learn a lot when you're mentoring other coaches as well, because they've got the philosophies and ideals, and there's some very talented people out there. So that was, it was sort of a dual role. And then off the back of that, then, after endurance, so I went to the Commonwealth Games as head of endurance. You know, the large percentage of the team were endurance athletes, which was good. And then off the back of that, I've just been appointed now head of Welsh athletics that encompasses all disciplines. And my, should we say, my philosophy now is that I'm actually investing in a coaching team in each event group and trying to, you know, obviously, upskill certain people, should we say, at regional level. I aren't personally doing that. I'm actually developing a team of people that will invest in the grassroots level and then at national development level. And above that, we've obviously got individual athletes that are working at a higher level, going to Olympics and the Commonwealth Games. So yes, it's a performance management role now.
Do you still keep your hands on though with any of the athletes, or is it definitely just hands off and performance management?
No, I have a small group. Again, it's really nice. I have a small group. So I have a coach, Charlotte Arter. So she was ranked number one last year at 10,000 in the UK, and she broke the Welsh record for the half marathon this year. So she ran in 69 minutes, and that's eighth on the all-time list. So she's somebody to look out for. There's a lot of things there, you know, talk about conditioning athletes properly that probably needed to be done a little bit earlier. She's got potential. There's no doubt about it. Our coach Jenny Nesbitt going to the World Student Games. She won the Inter-Counties. She went to the World Cross.
So, and Johnny Hopkins, who's ranked probably third, fourth on the steeplechase rankings and went to the Commonwealth Games. So I just have a nice group of three or four athletes that, I got an assistant coach. So when I'm in meetings, Liz Davis, my assistant, will just pick up on that level of coaching, you know, which is good.
You talked about coaching philosophy there, Chris. Let's get into that a little bit. If people have been listening closely, they'll have maybe picked up on a few things. But what you mentioned earlier about the human first, I've always been interested in your approach, because perhaps a lot of triathlon coaches feel that, you know, as long as they're right in the program, that's what the important thing is, and that it's the training that's most important. You seem to take a completely different approach. Can you explain a little bit about that and how that all came about?
I think, initially how it came about was just recognizing. I did a brutal 360 on myself when I was a head coach of British Triathlon, and I put a psychologist in the room, Olympic gold medalist Kirsten Barnes, and I just said to her, you know, find out what's good, what's not good, what Chris Jones is good at, not good at. And so, you know, when you put a lot of young athletes in the room, they're going to have an opinion, and that opinion done very clearly in two sections about who I was, should we say, as a coach at that time, and expectation from certain athletes and expectation from other athletes that perhaps they weren't getting as well. And that was a real reality check to make me realize that, right, I'm not really good in this big numbers area. That's one thing. And two, also, I this might sound crazy, but I've never asked a coach anybody from them ever in my whole 25, 30 years of working before. I've never said I could help you or I could do, I've never asked that. And I always believe, even now, when someone would ask me to help them, that one of the first pushbacks would be, you know, I'm asking you why. And what is your expectation? And I'm very comfortable in actually setting out. And I know whether I get the right fit or not fit, or I can give the right commitment. And I hope Tim Don wouldn't mind me saying this, but there was a certain point when Tim was a little bit of a crossroads, and I'd left British Triathlon. And Tim rang me, and he came down to Swansea, and we spent quite a week at a hotel, came round to my house in the morning, sat down, showed me all his training. And he basically turned around and said, you know, could you coach me? Could you work with me? And I actually said to him, Jesus, I said, Tim, you know, just give me a little bit of time to think on that. This guy, after this, went and ran that 28:50 when he ran that, the richest race. I can't remember what that was. The IV race, was it? Out in America. And it was just before this, and we talked about what he needed to get back to. But I remember turning to my wife at the time and just sort of saying, I can't do that. Can't do it. She said, why? You want you to coach? I said, no, I can't. I wanted to have a commitment, and I'd fall short on what you expect from me. And he was then probably one of our number one athletes, and obviously, somebody that started to be and to work with, and a huge admiration for him at the time. But what I'm trying to say there, that's a long winded story that most people wouldn't turn down coaching Tim Don. But what I'm actually trying to say to Simon is that there's a fit, and there's a fit that fits you as a coach, and it's the right fit at the right time. And I see so often coaches just happen to, you know, push themselves in certain coaching relationships or try take something on, and they don't even understand the person that's sat in front of them or what the expectation is or what this is about at this level. And so, no, I just try to say that's the first part of it, is understanding. Do I fit? Do I really want to work with? I don't have to work with anybody, and they don't have to work with me. Likewise, but the fact is, there's a mutual respect. Like we talked earlier about, you know, what is that relationship? I don't need to be anyone's best friend. I need to get on with people, and I need to establish what it is. And they have a dual responsibility also to accept how this is going to work. And you know that I think generally I have long coaching relationships. But also, there's a door always slightly open at the side there, thinking there's a point when I need to be honest to say, I think you need to change. I think you need to move on. You know, I don't own this space. We've had a great journey. We've really enjoyed it. Finola Britain was one. You know, you need to move on. I'm not going to be around. And you also, we've got a little bit stale. And there's nothing wrong with that. So I think, yeah, putting the person first is key, absolutely key.
When you were in Swansea, I was coaching an athlete called Dan Brook, if you can remember. Dan was having trouble. Dan was a great swimmer and cyclist. He would have been a perfect domestique for the Brownies in London, you know, because he could swim and cycle as well as them. He struggled with his running. And I mean, his running wasn't that bad. He could run 33 minutes for 10K, but Dan was never going to run 30 minutes. But we were trying to improve his running, and he asked if he could come down to Swansea after he'd finished at Loughborough. So he came to see you, and that was, I think, an interesting relationship, because you and I worked together. I was looking after his program, but you were looking after his running, and he used to go in the lab, didn't he, with Bernie and do stuff there. Yeah. And that was an interesting coaching partnership, which I think seemed to work quite well. But you've got to have two coaches who are comfortable not being in complete control of the reins. But the thing that impressed me about when Dan came down was that one of the first things you did was pop round to see him on his first night, made sure that he was happy with where he was living, you know, made sure he knew where the shops were, and just trying to help him bed into his environment, because to me it was like there was an understanding that if he was comfortable in his environment, then he's going to turn up for training on time. He's going to have a bit more commitment and consistency than if he's unhappy in his environment.
Yeah, I think that goes likewise. These youngsters, sometimes the first time he's travelled all the way from Halifax, Yorkshire, Richie Nicholls travelled all the way down from Scotland. I remember his mum just sort of dropping him off over to you. And it's great when you're swimming from down a pool and meeting for a bike ride. But outside that downtime, then there's a point there where you're just trying to stop them down. And there's a lot of ownership goes on in endurance sports because it's lonely, not a team sport. So I think there's a lot of responsibility just to sort of get them in the right fit. And you know when someone's struggling in that environment, and you probably know when they're not going to be able to settle, shall we say. But, you know, I think if you've got the right environment and you're talking about those things and you've got the right support people around you, then they can, you know, just put an arm around people when they need it, or you can have that conversation, how are you doing? Because I always say that usually the things that come up and cause issues or they're normally not related to sport. They're normally related to just life. And I think that's why the person is important. And, that's part of the job as being a coach. There's no doubt about that.
Just before I ask you for some tips for our age groupers, Chris, one of the things I can remember, a significant moment, was a conversation with you about probably after a reflection on the Olympics. You said to me, they've got to be running under 30 minutes for 10K. That's what's going to win the Olympic gold medal. It was, I mean, I know Alistair ran under that for London, but it must have been sort of several years before that. How did you come to that decision? Knowing you, I know it wouldn't have just been a figure that you were plucking out of the air and going, yeah, he needs to run under 30 minutes. And I actually remember back in the early days of the Talent ID programs, we were wanting the athletes to be able to show that they could run 3 minutes per kilometer, even if it was just 2 kilometers for the young ones and three kilometers for the older ones. We had to have them, they had to be running under 3 minutes per kilometer. I think that was probably where we had that conversation. And you said, when these guys get to senior level, they'll need to run sub 30 minutes for 10K. So how did you develop that ability to look into the future so far?
So look, coming back to that, you know, we were looking around as we were the young sport, Simon, and if you look at other sports, and particularly athletics, you know, they were talking about breaking 13 minutes then, Moorcroft for 10K, and he didn't quite do it. So where we were at, you know, if you just look at those people on the Steve Jones of this world, the marathon, that generation of athletes, to see, after starting to understand a little bit more about this, half marathon velocities, do we hold that up a bike? What is our flat 10K versus the drop off of our 10K? If you look at sort of a higher, what we call the threshold, anaerobic threshold, if we talk about it, or the lactic threshold, it's quite easy to just backtrack up those calculations. Actually, we should be able to run a lot faster off the bike, because the limiting factor here is metabolic. It was never a metabolic decision, limitation, sorry, that was going to stop you running. it was purely a mechanical thing. And he was actually having the ability to get the bike, get into the mechanical power to run the first kilometre, which they eventually started to do in 250, 255, and faster, obviously, as you know, when people go out hard now on the run. But so to me, we were already starting to see glimpses that people could try and do that. So they were coming off hard and trying to drop people in the first part of the races, but they couldn't sustain it because they probably didn't have the proper condition. And as we understand more about it, also what changed significantly is the body type of these athletes. The athletes are the Morris and the Downleys and those type of guys. They're very athletic, they're very lean. And Whitfield also, as I said, was a game changer. And you could see those things. So they've only done what I expected them to do. And they're doing, I'm surprised the women's running to get the odd female athlete that can do it. But we're not seeing an abundance of female athletes doing it like the men. And so, you know, I just think, the level of training absorption that the senior athletes take in the men's division is better. And they're now getting that the metabolic profile is good. They're more powerful and the skillful, and they understand how to go with the right running mechanics, having been fatigued on the bike. They know how to do that. So I never thought that was the limiting factor there was not metabolic. It was understanding how you're going to do it in the sport. So the speed wasn't a really, something that was like off the scale to me in thinking, gosh, that's unbelievable. It's not unbelievable. It's actually well within a lot of our athletes' range. If they condition themselves properly, that's all.
Right.
That's how I probably would have always thought about it, you mean?
Okay. So there was me thinking you had some sort of magical skills to look into the future, Chris, into your magic ball. You've just blown the myth out. You've just blown that myth out of the water.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So we've got a group of age groupers who are listening to this. Recreational athletes. Working, family, life issues, as you said, it's usually those things that derail training. With a man of your experience, you've worked right across the board, you've worked with elite athletes in several different sports, but you were working with decent age groupers and you started off there and you've gotten a good understanding of the sport. Yeah. And I know that you can bring things down to the sort of first principles. So if you were going to give some advice to our listeners about how to improve their athletic performances, what would the key things be that they need to keep in mind all the time?
I know you've mentioned this before in discussions, and I think this has sort of become a stronger mantra as I've developed, or got older, maybe not wiser, but definitely got older. Simon, I think you have to do a few things exceptionally well. That doesn't mean reading every journal, reading every training plan and trying to follow everything. But you need to identify. So just for example, we go in the pool. A lot of age groups have got a pool. They've got great swimmers. They can't develop technical feel at 15, 16 years. They can't work on those things. But that skill and motor learning part will not be the same. So take some shortcuts and become very good at pulling. Stick a pool boy between your legs because 9 out of 10 you're swimming in a neoprene suit. Look at the rate at what you're swimming and just focus on that specific area in your swimming and become very, very good at it. That's just one tip in those areas. You know, when you're balancing out what you're doing with your, the whole programming, I think it's interesting how people who do like CrossFit or they do just general, body conditioning type exercises, how quickly they transition to triathlon. The reason why they do that is because the body, the just general conditioning levels are better. They have more elasticity, they're stiffer, they have better muscle tone, they have better level of power output and things. So don't underestimate that you can get a long way as an age group athlete with a very busy schedule by just focusing on a few principles. As conditioning goes, I would really recommend that they do get into a generally good semi-conditioning program. And it might sound a little bit over the top, but just a few basic lifts of like deadlifts, cleans and squats off season twice a week will make a significant difference in particularly cycling and particularly running. Do those. They're generally just out the bike, churning out the volume, churning out the miles. So it's specific race-based block work. That's doing a few things. So I cut back on the general churn and what they're doing and look at actually what it is that will make a difference. And usually with the age group athlete, particularly if we start talking of the more senior athletes, 40 upwards, you need to look at your body. You need to look at the level of general fitness that they have. And also then they need to protect themselves from some injuries and things. And then the other athletes who are really, really, shall we say, keen, got the ability, doesn't have as many restrictions around his family and things, then you need to be smart about what you're doing with that training. And also, one of the major things for me would be how you actually balance the schedule. So we know there's an optimum 10-day load that you could probably take on. People say, well, I take weeks off. No, 10 days is about where you should be, 4 days recovery, or a 2-day week cycle, and then 1 week down. I don't see that, when I'm talking to age group athletes, they just tend to do the same thing week in, week out. They don't move it around enough, and they don't build in enough recovery. And I think that's one of the things that is key, that you want to be consistent, is the key word. You want to be healthy, and you want to be structurally strong. If those are the principles you hold on to, the rest will take care of itself. You'll progress.
Yeah, going back to the, person we talked about right at the beginning of this conversation, Dan Plews. Dan's mantra for his business is health, performance, longevity. And, you have to have, it seems contrary to what's right, but most people have a top-down approach. So they start with the training and then they try to make everything else fit. So that, if things are going wrong, they look at, well, how can I get more sleep? I'm a great believer in the fact that you do it from the bottom up. So you make sure you're getting enough sleep. You make sure your nutrition's right. You make sure you've got balance in your life. And then you add the training into that in what time's left. And the certainly for a long-term benefits, that's going to be far more productive and far more, allow a far more consistent approach to training than the other way, where you're sort of just trying to shoehorn things in and you end up having to correct and fix things when it all starts to go wrong.
No, you're right. I used to often talk to you about athletes. There's like a maybe. There's a maybe sort of philosophy. Maybe I can do this, or the about syndrome. I mean, about this shape, which used to frustrate the hell out of me as a coach when, coaches say to me, oh, they're in about this shape. So, okay, what's the about then? That's the reality of just not being able to do it A and B that equals C. So if you want to run 3 miles, for example, in 15 minutes, but you can't run 2 miles in 5 minutes, you're not going to run, one mile in 5 minutes. It's keeping it simple, but there's an honesty there. And if you want to ride at 280 watts for whatever, and you're going to do 2 40-minute sections, then go test it. 4 times 20 minutes. Go find out that you can do it. Keep an honesty check so that you're then in control of what you're doing. Don't stand on the line saying, maybe, or I'm in about shape. Know you're there. Know you're in that shape. And that's then what you can do then is to manage that properly to get the best performance. But when you're in this maybe or about syndrome, you don't know where you are. And that's the problem. That is the problem with a lot of people, is that it's a little bit of a cross-fingers approach. And they just don't understand how to put those performance markers in their build-up that gives an honesty and a reality to say, well, this is where I'm at. That's progress, and I'll build from there next time. Instead, they're trying to shoot for the stars. The whole thing unravels because they don't have the maturity to understand where they're at. And advice there is, what are your, what are the performance indicators? What are the check set? Who age groupers? Is it, 4 times 400 in the pool? Is it 2 times 20 minutes on the road at a certain watt or speed or heart rate? Build them in. Don't shy away, because that's one of the areas I feel that people do shy away from.
That's probably a good place to finish that, Chris. I love it. Know where you're at, not about or maybe. Be precise and have a good, realistic understanding of what your fitness is when you step onto that start line.
Yeah.
Oh, Chris, it's been great. 25 years, and we've summed it all up in one nice conversation today. Thank you so much. It's been a great conversation. I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show.
It has, and just to finish, from working with age groupers to elite athletes, for me, it's been a great opportunity, and it's also been a huge learning experience. And
it's something that I've appreciated. It's something that I've appreciated in building friendships with people like yourself and all the athletes that you touch on the way, in a sense of like helping. And that's possibly why we do it, isn't it? That's why we do it. It's what motivates us, in a sense of just being able to make a difference. So thanks for the opportunity. You know, I'll still carry on coaching, but it's been a lovely journey so far anyway. Thanks.
Brilliant. Well, there you go, listeners. That was a friend of mine, elite performance coach, Chris Jones. I hope you've learned something from that. As always, chatting to Chris, I've learned a lot today. So thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with another equally fantastic guest. I do keep trying, but every time we have a guest on, they raise the bar and we have to search a bit further to bring you somebody else that's going to keep that bar high. So thanks to Chris. Listeners, I'll see you again next week. So for now, enjoy the rest of your day. That's a wrap for this week's episode. Thank you so much for listening to the conversation, and I hope you learned at least one thing. If this is the first time you've listened in, please go back and take a listen to some of our previous guests, and I can guarantee they will be just as good as the one you've just heard. If you've been a regular listener, then thank you for being a part of this journey with me so far. Finally, I'd like to take just a few seconds to tell you about my SWOT Inner Circle program. In the last few years, I've spent an awful lot of time creating training programs and resources to help you train and race at whatever triathlon distance you choose, and for some of the events outside of triathlon like aquabike, duathlon and swim run events. As a SWOT member, you get access to all of these plans for 12 months of the year, and on top of that we provide guidance on strength and conditioning, nutrition, plus a whole host of other supportive activities which help you to train, recover and race better. We also have a really friendly Facebook community. It's an exclusive Facebook page for SWOT members only, and there are over 150 of them already. If you join, you'll be able to get access to that page, and you'll be able to ask for help, and our members are all too happy to provide guidance and advice based on their experiences. I'll also be there to help you find solutions to your training problems, and all you have to do is tag me in the Facebook page in one of your posts, or you can book a 15-minute phone call should you need one. If you'd like more information, or if you're ready to press the button and join the SWOT Inner Circle, just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she will send you all of the details. So that's all for this week. Hopefully I'll see you again next week, same time, same place, with a different guest.